gesucht werden. Leocadia Beckwick, Dreieinigkeitsmoses und Fetti der Prokurist. Alle drei sind flüchtig.
Hallo, wir müssen weiter.
Aber der Wagen ist kaputt.
Ja, dann können wir nicht weiter.
Aber wir müssen weiter.
Aber vor uns ist nur Wüste.
Ja, dann können wir nicht weiter.
Also müssen wir umkehren?
Aber hinter uns sind die Konstabler, die uns von Angesicht zu Angesicht kennen.
Ja, dann können wir nicht umkehren.
Oben an der Küste wird aber doch Gold gefunden.
Ja, die Küste, die ist lang.
Ja, dann können wir eben nicht hin.
Aber es wird dort Gold gefunden.
Ja, aber die Küste ist so lang.
Geht es nicht weiter?
Nein!
Gut, wenn wir nicht hinauf können, werden wir hier unten bleiben. Seht, alle Leute, die von dort herunterkamen, sagten, dass die Flüsse das Gold sehr ungern hergeben. Aber ich habe diese Leute gesehen und ich sage euch, sie geben das Gold her. Ihr bekommt leichter das Gold von Männern als von Flüssen.
I would like to thank the Schulte Foundation U.S. for the 2009 Sir George Schulte Conducting Award, most importantly to thank them for the unique decision they made in 2004 to support young American conductors. While I was growing up in Iowa and Kansas, I was searching for a reason why American orchestras hire European music directors, and a possible explanation I first encountered at the Interlochen Arts Camp in high school. There, I started hearing about German opera houses serving as a common training ground for young conductors. Maestro Schulte was in Frankfurt at the opera house, as was Christoph von Dohjani. Wolfgang Sawallisch was everywhere in Germany, including Munich, George Zell in Berlin, Kurt Masur in Leipzig. It dawned on me that these symphonic conductors were actually operatic conductors. Today, we have the trend of separating the fields, and this appeared to be at the root of a great problem in educating young American conductors. In the United States, young conductors are forced to choose between a position either as an assistant conductor for a symphony orchestra or as a pianist in one of the few opera houses. The first option, for the most part, ignores operatic repertoire entirely, and the second prefers hiring trained vocal pianists to aspiring conductors. Ideally, we need a position in the middle of these extremes. The music industry, on the other hand, hardly helps the situation when it broadcasts a message that the greatest gift a young conductor can have is charisma. This search for the charismatic 20-something-year-old conductor spreads a myth that youth and conducting are compatible. In this race against age, there is little incentive left for a young conductor to invest a great deal of time in his or her training. And without proper training, conducting is quickly reduced to gestures and choreography. We rob the young conductors of the opportunity to build their repertoire and to grow musically in a protected environment, which my favorite conductors seem to achieve in their early years of training in opera houses. So I decided, as a 24-year-old in 2001, to come to Germany. I joined the musical staff at the opera house in Frankfurt, where Dohjani and Schulte served as music directors. I crammed my possessions into two suitcases, mailed 8 boxes of scores, and although I was very scared, my heart told me that Wolfgang Sawallisch can read a Strauss or a Wagner opera like a newspaper, and that I had to give my best to achieve exactly that skill. The beauty of the Schulte Foundation U.S. is that through their offer of financial support, more and more young American conductors can and will begin to evaluate the present system more critically. I think if we are to train music directors in this country, we require a longer, more challenging path than the one that is presently taken and encouraged. The Schulte Foundation U.S., by its very name, helps illuminate a path slightly hidden but already paved and made by a great conductor whom I never had the privilege to meet. They have accepted this responsibility to maintain and preserve Maestro Schulte's path and to support and nurture its travelers. I think the image of the path is a good reminder that even the most gifted young conductors have a long journey to undertake. No one is born with the ability to read a score, to navigate through 400 years of music history, to be able to speak languages, to orchestrate, to accompany, to shape a musical phrase. Young American conductors and the music industry really need the Schulte Foundation U.S. They need to be reminded about the path of Maestro Sir George Schulte.
We thought it would be an interesting way to start today's program, and an inviting way as well, to have our guest Eric Nielsen actually read the statement you heard him read just now. It's the statement that he sent by video to the dinner of the Schulte Foundation U.S. here in Chicago in October. He wasn't able to attend that dinner because he was working in the Opera House in Frankfurt in Germany, but he's here in Chicago when we're speaking with him in early November, and I thought it would give you an idea of just how thoughtful and sensitive and articulate Mr. Nielsen is, and also to get a sense, particularly we hope, appropriate for this program, of the way he thinks critically and the way he hopes that others will think critically about conducting, and that other conductors and those who aspire to become conductors will themselves cast a critical eye on what it takes to become a conductor. Eric Nielsen, congratulations on being this year's recipient of the Conducting Award and future Conducting Encouragement Award of the Schulte Foundation U.S., and welcome to Chicago and welcome to WFMT.
Thank you.
We'll come back to some of the points, maybe all of the points or many of the points that you make in that sort of statement of purpose, we might say. But why don't we get some background on you first, Eric, and also on how you and the Schulte Award came together. You are from the great orchestral metropolis of Council Bluffs, Iowa. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And how did you actually studied oboe and harp, one with each arm? Or how did you wind up playing either and both of them? And then where did conducting come into the picture?
You don't need the mouth to play the harp. So that was very practical. I grew up in Kansas City. And there, my school district of Kansas City, Kansas, was starting a harp program. And I had started the oboe as a 10-year-old in fifth grade in school music program. And the teacher that I was working with on the oboe, his name's Richard Bateman, I went to his apartment one day and had an oboe lesson, and he sat me down at one of the harps. And luckily, my mother, we had one of the largest tanks imaginable as a station wagon. And after this lesson, I had a harp in the back of this car, yeah.
You talk about a music mother, I mean, that she was willing to not only take you around to lessons, but your harp as well.
She's a professional chauffeur, yeah.
Do you still play either instrument?
Yes. Wow. Yeah, I don't play the oboe very much because it's in Europe, it's a very different instrument.
Right.
But the harp I play regularly with the first flutist of the Radio Symphony in Frankfurt, and that's very enjoyable.
Very cool. And you just don't want to admit that you don't want to spend all day making reeds.
Being an oboist requires 2 hours of being a carpenter every day, and so I generally don't have that.
You have enough other obligations, I would imagine. And so you went off to Juilliard.
That's right.
And then where did conducting come into the picture?
At Juilliard, I was there 4 years for my undergrad, and I met Otto Werner Müller, who's the conducting professor there.
And he's forever.
He's been there since, I think, 84.
But, yeah.
So I decided after graduating that I would audition for him, and he's also the professor of conducting at Curtis in Philadelphia, and he took me there. He tends to take younger students to Curtis, and So I was there 2 years studying with him.
But what was it that made you say, not so much I want to study with Otto Werner Mueller or Curtis or Juilliard, but here I am already mastering or attempting to master these two instruments. I now want to stand up in front of an orchestra or in the pit of an opera house.
I always wanted to be a conductor. When I was actually 3 years old, I went to a small Lutheran church in Iowa, and when the chorus would sing, I would stand in the aisle and mimic the movements of the chorus director. But I had very good instruction. One of my conducting teachers at Interlaken, Henry Charles Smith, told me, don't concentrate on conducting, concentrate on making music in as many ways as possible, and that is the best way to study conducting. And so that I always knew I was going to be a conductor, but I wanted to invest as much time as possible in playing in orchestras and learning the orchestral repertoire by sitting amongst musicians.
It's so important, and it's also so interesting how right now a number of these areas and these ideas seem to be coming together around the world and with a certain nexus in Chicago, because for Riccardo Muti, these are all extremely important things as well. He thinks it's very important for a conductor to understand how instruments work and to have the experience of building voices and working with people in an opera company as well as in a symphony orchestra, that it's an artificial wall, as you indicated in your statement. And the other Schulte Fellowship that is going to start under the auspices of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Maestro Muti and Lady Schulte, is specifically to have a young conductor come and work with the maestro, work with the orchestra throughout the year, but also to work with singers while he or she is doing that. You also see in the work that Maestro Barenboim did in Chicago and that he does in Berlin, where he very much takes people and has them work in both sides of these areas. And also the concern that is being expressed by many people that a conductor, if he or she starts off, quote, studying conducting, what is it that that person is studying? And does one lose sight of the point that if you're not making music and if you're not helping others to make music, why are you there at all? The idea that you're standing in front of all these people waving your arms around as opposed to what you have to produce if you're in the pit and nobody sees you except the musicians, yet everybody hears your work, that distinction, that purpose gets lost.
Absolutely. I think it's a, in particular, it's the question of solving problems when you're standing up. If you're not helpful for the orchestra, why are you standing there? And I think that requires a lot of experience. As an oboist, I can sit in a woodwind section and I know that the second bassoon is too sharp or the second horn is too soft. And if we could just fix those few things, then the intonation would be better. So having that experience, it's very easy for me to stand on the podium and fix the problems quickly. But that's only because I have a 12-year experience of playing Brahms symphonies mm-hmm. as a principal oboist. And that said, for the operatic side, it's very difficult when, for opera in general, we're looking for pianists, and these pianists often are not able to deal with an orchestra. They can work very well with singers, mm-hmm. but working with the orchestras is a completely different animal.
Right.
And I think that's a something that, for me, it was always the question of taking both forks in the road, so mm-hmm. to speak, and doing both of them as much as possible.
Have you ever met or worked with Anthony Pappano, Tony Pappano? Because Tony started off as a pianist with the Lyric Opera. His wife still is a repetiteur from time to time here. And, of course, he's gone on to great success both in the opera house and in symphony conducting.
He was also in Frankfurt as a coach.
Right, right.
That
okay.
was one of his first positions. I've never worked with him, mm-hmm. but I admire his work. And I know people who sing for him, and they always speak very highly of what he does.
But again, somebody who tried to solve this problem of the forked road and returning it to some kind of a single path.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's a question of addressing the two issues separately. How does a symphony orchestra work, and how on earth can you learn the symphonic and the operatic repertoire?
Here you were 23, 24 years old in 2000, 2001, And what did you do? Write a fan letter to Wolfgang Sawallisch? I mean, how did you get to the point where you were able to pack those suitcases and go?
I wish I wrote a fan letter to him. I always admired what he did. And I find this story of him playing, there was a snowstorm in Philadelphia, and he on the concert was Tannhäuser and Die Walküre excerpts. And the orchestra just simply couldn't show up. And so they pulled a grand piano out and he played.
Wow.
And this is the most inspiring thing. This is what conducting is to me, is to have a complete mastery of the repertoire, and that it's in the mind so clearly that's the sensation I have as a conductor. When I've studied a score, I can play it at the piano. When I haven't studied it, I'm just picking notes out of air. I don't know what I'm doing. But at Juilliard, Marie-Pierre Lenglumé came and gave a master class, and she's the principal harpist of the Berlin Philharmonic. In Germany, we have very nice programs for young musicians. Each orchestra has an academy. The Berlin Philharmonic has an academy, and she suggested to me to audition for this academy. And it's a wonderful position because as I was accepted, I function as the second harpist in that orchestra. So I got to play the last season of Abbado as a music director. And I played Parsifal under him. I played Gurlieder under Rattle. And that was my first year after I left Curtis. That was actually what I did. And I decided just to stay 1 year, and I wanted to audition as quickly as possible for opera houses in Germany. Mm-hmm. So that was my first program to get to Berlin, and then I got my job in Frankfurt.
So you went over there, you were playing the harp, and then doing auditions for programs or apprenticeships.
Exactly.
And you got it to go to Frankfurt.
It was I was just lucky to have a way of getting my residency permit in Germany. So and it was actually not very complicated. It was, of course, stressful to play in that orchestra, but it was so interesting to start at that level, which is the mm-hmm. highest in Germany, if not the world, and to see how differently the German orchestra plays and also how they think differently.
Give us some examples of that.
Well, they of course, I mean, a lot of conductors, I don't mean to talk about the stereotypical thing, but a lot of conductors talk about how German orchestras play later than the beat, mm-hmm. whereas when a conductor gives an upbeat, and now, but in Germany it would be and now. They're always a little after the downbeat. The ictus is what we call it in conducting. Mm-hmm. But it's also they how they handle auditions, for example, in the United States. Unions are it's all very clear that you have the auditions take place behind a screen. No one sees who's playing. In Germany, you've got the whole orchestra sitting there staring at every candidate, and they will come to a consensus or they won't, and sometimes you'll have an audition or many times many auditions where they just don't accept a candidate, and it's mm-hmm. it's a different system. They how the instruments work, I think, is the most important. One of the first pieces I did in Berlin was the Schoenberg Pelléas et Mélisande, and I was sitting next to the bassoons and the trombones, and they had an automatic way of blending in this repertoire which you would really have to rehearse a lot with an American orchestra. Now, having that said, there are certain things that an American orchestra can do, which a German orchestra would also have great difficulty doing. Mm-hmm. Precision, this type of brilliance in playing. The German orchestra is a very dark color in general. But that starting with Berlin was a good way of knowing that there's not only one way that an orchestra can function, and I think that I had a one-sided approach, and now I have I can see the grass is always greener on both sides.
That's a very good way of putting it. I'm curious, maybe you didn't have the time during that period in Berlin, but maybe you've had time since then for the 8 or so years that you've been in Germany, now been based there. There's also suggested by many listeners and performers still a distinction between some of the companies and orchestras that wound up behind the Iron Curtain in what was for a period East Germany and those in the West, and that it is said that these very old historic orchestras, opera orchestras in Berlin, in Dresden, in Leipzig, I mean, it just happened these great historic spots all wound up in the Eastern, in the Soviet sector, and then in East Germany. And I'm wondering, you know, Mr. Barenboim talks about this. I think we both know Stephen Fitzpatrick, who's the harpist in the East Berlin mm-hmm. Orchestra and the Staatsoper in Mr. Barenboim's orchestra, also coming from outside of Germany to do that. Did you get a sense, or do you get a sense, either with players or when you move around conducting or listening to companies and orchestras in Germany, if that difference persists, and if so, what have you benefited from learning about that?
Yeah, I'm making generalities about German orchestras, but they all play very differently. And I know in Berlin, for example, we know the Berlin Philharmonic is one of the greatest orchestras in the world, but the Staatskapelle, where Barenboim is the boss, is an incredible orchestra. And some in Berlin would say as good, if not better, than the Berlin Philharmonic. And it's a question of how they play very differently. And in Dresden,
how would you describe the different way that some of these orchestras play?
It's I don't know the Orchestra of Dresden. I know it's one of the it is the oldest orchestra, I believe, in the world. It has a tremendous tradition. I have heard a recording of them play Richard Strauss Salome with Ozawa. And it's simply obvious that this orchestra knows how to play Strauss better than any other orchestra. The music was written for them, and they can simply read between the lines and figure out a way to make this very dense material sound very transparent and letting the words come through. I've also spoken to conductors who've worked in Bayreuth, and they mentioned that as a problem with that orchestra in terms of a lot of the effort was to get the musicians from the West and the East to play in a similar style. Mm-hmm. And I just don't have enough experience with Eastern German orchestras to know exactly how to right. describe it.
There is this idea of tradition and of localized tradition, we could say, in orchestras in Germany.
I mean, if you're talking to the Leipzig Gewandhaus, they know what they're doing when they do Mendelssohn.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's where he lived. That's where he, you know, Leipzig, also with Bach, where Johann Sebastian Bach worked there. And in Dresden, you have Strauss. That's just what it is.
One can get a little boxed in as well, can't one, in this kind of thing. I remember talking with Pierre Boulez in Salzburg after he had conducted Mahler for the first time with the Vienna Philharmonic. So not the first time he conducted the Philharmonic and not the first time he conducted Mahler, but in the mid-90s, the first time he'd conducted them in Mahler. And he was telling us that in some of the early rehearsals, he was not able to get certain things that he wanted. And finally, one of the concertmeisters said, "You know, Maestro, we played this under Mahler." And Boulez said, "You did not play this under Mahler. Maybe your grandpapa played it under Mahler." But there can be an idea of ownership that perhaps has less of that, what you also were indicating before, whereas an American orchestra, and certainly this was something Schulte talked about a lot, why he chose to spend so much time with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, that it becomes an instrument that will respond to any conductor and give a different sound. So maybe there's something to be gained from all of these, yeah?
There is a certain amount of pride in how an orchestra plays. And so you say, this is how we play in Berlin. This is how we play in Boston. This is how we play in New York. And I think we think a lot about the music director as determining that. I actually believe that the greatest influence for how an orchestra plays is their hall, where they work. Mm-hmm. The Chicago Symphony Hall, the sound, it's like a skyscraper. It soars. When you have a forte, it can just have an explosion. And the Chicago Symphony, they know that and they play it. I've played a few notes on the Academy Music stage in Philadelphia. You feel like your sound moves maybe 6 inches and stops. Mm-hmm. It feels so dead that it's no wonder that that orchestra was desperate to create resonance in the sound that they have. And so in a sense, I find it somewhat of a tragedy that Philadelphia has a new hall, because this orchestra was so defined by the Academy of Music. And, of course, Severance Hall in Cleveland,
right.
That orchestra, it's a wonderful hall, and it was just allowed the orchestra to breathe and make chamber music for most of their concerts. And we can say the same thing about Berlin. It's an extraordinary hall. And I actually think that the hall is more... It determines more the sound of an orchestra than actually the conductor himself or herself.
I feel at a real disadvantage in talking with our guest Eric Nielsen here, because as you can hear from Eric's commentary, he could very easily have my job as a critic. He is such a perceptive listener and such an articulate explainer of the things that he hears, and I wouldn't have any chance of taking any of his jobs, be they oboe, harp, or podium. So take it away, Eric. No, but seriously, it's wonderful to talk with somebody who is thinking as he leads an orchestra or plays in an orchestra about what is the experience of the audience, what is the experience of history, what is the experience of place. We should tell you, too, since you're listening on the radio, that Eric Nielsen is spelled in fine Scandinavian form, E-R-I-K, and Nielsen is N-I-E-L-S-E-N. So I imagine being an Iowa Lutheran, you have good Scandinavian cred.
Danish,
okay. Well, you and Nielsen. Do you play any Nielsen?
I haven't. And I really never want to see a CD saying Nielsen conducts Nielsen, because that would be a real shame.
It'd be Nielsen times 2 now, or Nielsen 2.0. But someday, perhaps, we'll have you back for the big Nielsen on Nielsen conversation. How did you and the Schulte folks come together?
I was at Tanglewood in 2007, and I heard from one of the students of Betty Bucherry, who is on the Artistic and Awards Committee of the Schulte Foundation U.S., and this colleague, a pianist at Tanglewood, told me that they're looking for young conductors to apply for this grant. And I thought, well, I've never heard of this foundation. And as I mentioned, they only started supporting young conductors exclusively in 2004, so it was a very new thing. And I was out of the country for quite a while. And I applied, sent in videos. It was a very extensive application process with sending CVs and personal statements, and as any foundation would expect. And then I heard back from the committee that they were interested, but they wanted to see me conduct live. And so I had a project in Berlin in the summer, it was actually the most gratifying conducting I've ever done. It was a student production of Mozart concert arias fused together into an opera done by a young stage director. And this is some of the most exquisite Mozart music that I know. I would say it's my favorite. And one of the members of the committee, Philip Moorhead, who's on staff at Lyric Opera, came and flew to Berlin and watched my general and the premiere of this production. And then after that, I received word that I would get the grant.
You point out some things in this that I think are important for people to know more about. And one of those is, and this is important, I think, both for the recipients of the award and for people looking at the awardees. The jury of the Schulte Foundation U.S. is not a celebrity jury. These people are celebrities within their fields, in that these are the unsung heroes. These are the really hard workers on the music scene here in Chicago who have decades of experience working with Schulte, Margaret Hillis, Daniel Barenboim, Bruno Bartoletti, and now Sir Andrew Davis at the Lyric. Philip Moorhead is the music administrator and a frequent conductor at Lyric. And Betty Bucherry is the pianist behind the scenes for everybody, the advisor, the coach, the raconteur of the real work in the Chicago music scene. And the same can be said of their other colleagues on the jury. So one, it sort of is an extra certifying stamp for other people to say, gosh, they picked this person because he or she really has a project in mind or has something that we need to listen to and to see. And for the recipient, it's a chance to say that sort of some of the best of your peers have listened to you and looked you over. And it wasn't a question of, well, you sat next to this person's wife at that dinner, which, hey, if you get the award, it's great, but might be the case with some other grant or award from somewhere else. So
this is the most exciting thing about working in an opera house, is the people behind the scenes have to be so unbelievably qualified to do their work. And so someone like Philip Moorhead or Betty Bucherry, you're assisting conductors in projects. You've got to know every note of the opera you're doing. You've got to know the translations, and you've got to help the singers. It can be such rewarding work to support and be a part of a project. And I think you gain so much experience through the years of working in opera houses that I feel very privileged that they were able to look at me in my early stages of career and say, that's the right direction for a young conductor. It's nice to have that stamp of approval, so to speak.
Now, most of your career has been in Europe at this point, and you referred to having been in Tanglewood in 07. You came there to work with James Levine, and you came there again in 2008. You thought to work with James Levine, and Maestro Levine had some serious health problems that fortunately he addressed right away. And you wound up not only being in Tanglewood then, but having to conduct Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht, The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, and the Elliot Carter Clarinet Concerto, and I think some other Carter piece or pieces as well, and to have to conduct those in performance in place of Maestro Levine. Tell us a little bit about Eric Nielsen's summer of 2008 in Tanglewood, Massachusetts.
Well, it was first, it was an incredible summer. First of all, Bernard Haitink came and conducted the Alpine Symphony with the Tanglewood Music Center Festival Orchestra. And I was conducting on the very same program, Debussy Afternoon of a Faun. And so I had Haitink coaching me on this piece. And it was very strange. At the concert, Levine wasn't there. And Levine always comes to the concerts. And indeed, the next day we heard that he was very ill and had to cancel. So I was scheduled to conduct the last of three performances of Mahagoni. I was supposed to assist Levine. And I waited a few days. I didn't hear. I figured that the Tanglewood would look for a star conductor to replace him. And I found out about 3 days later that Levine wanted me to do the whole production. I was astonished, and I thought, well, I want to make sure that the vocalists who are spending the whole summer in Tanglewood feel that this is still worthwhile, and I want to have their support. If they can grab a famous conductor to come and do it, they should do that because it's an 8-week investment of time. But no, that was decided that I would do that production, and it's a very rewarding piece as a conductor to do because it's so eclectic. It's so many different styles, and you feel we did it in English, which was also good, but it's still it's also a German piece, and I know the original in German, and we were working with the translation, and it was just really such an exciting project to do, and such a wonderful piece. When it works, it can be very effective. And but after the first stage orchestra rehearsals, I had the privilege to go to New York and visit Levine, and I brought videos of the rehearsals, and there he was. I was able to spend an afternoon with him, and we looked at the videos, and I was able to see how a mind like his can look at an opera, and he just had the remote control in his hand. He'd press pause and would say, I'm doing this, tell the tenor this, tell the orchestra this, tell the stage director this, and then play again. And it's tell the tenor he's too it's too reflective. It's too calculated. And then I'm conducting, and I start the tempo, but I lose 5% because I give time for the singer to breathe at the end of the fourth bar. And he says I do the same thing. I doubt it, but he told me to support me. And he was able to, at lightning speed, to appraise the entire production. And it was I, of course, wrote every word down. I was scribbling like mad. I was a court reporter at that. But there are still things today when I and he told me it's when you work with singers, I told him once, it was in the newspaper. I said, you know, if I tell the horns they need to play shorter, they're just going to hate me. And he said, let them hate you. That's what it was about. Mm-hmm. It was about the product. And of course, I'm not there to make their lives miserable, but it's about what I'm hearing. And he gave me that. He also told me, you know, you can stop in a moment and say to the stage or whatever, you know, I know we haven't had time to do this, but if we don't get this right now, it will never be right. And it's this what it means. We can never neglect this as conductors, that it is 95% leadership.
And it's establishing that leadership and winning over the understanding so that you can exercise your authority. You can't just come in and start telling people this, this, and this because they say, why do we care what this kid says?
Absolutely. And it's the realization that the conductor is perhaps the boss, but the composer is always the boss over the conductor. And if the people realize that the conductor is representing the composer as best he or she can, then they will rank and file, do exactly what the consensus is. What are we there doing? Why are we making music together? And I think the good conductors remind the orchestra all the time, why do they spend so many hours taking private lessons? It's a collective trained instrument. They're all very gifted. They've all nitpicked and they know what this means, and they want to do it together.
Were you having to prepare the viol and the Carter dialogues and clarinet concerto all at the same time?
It came roughly. The Carter came immediately, so I had to learn. I had to learn the dialogues quickly. And that was a privilege to work with.
You had a great soloist in Nicholas Hodges, yeah.
It was frightening.
Who's also quite a character.
he was a real privilege. And you know, one time I asked him at a certain point, I said, what about the tempo here? And he said, you know, I can play it at any tempo. And I thought, I believe you.
He can do anything.
Yeah. And he of course, he's played with Levine, with Boulez, with Barenboim, this piece. So
right.
I thought, okay.
So were the butterflies all canceling each other out? You've got Haitink, you've got Levine. I imagine Elliot Carter might have been at these performances, or if not, he's certain. He misses none of his performances. So.
He was there, yeah. And sitting basically 15 feet away from me.
At the time, he was only 99, so.
Only.
Yeah, right. Your title now is Kapellmeister in Frankfurt. Explain that to us.
Kapellmeister is somewhat like assistant conductor. My contract in Frankfurt says that I conduct 23 evenings a season. And the German season, operatic season, is quite long. It's basically the entire year except about a six-week summer vacation. And so this season I conduct La Bohème. I conduct a modern opera, Simplicius Simplicissimus. I do Lucia de Lammermoor, and I do Zauberflöte in Frankfurt.
So you've got a range of time periods and of styles to do in these operas that you're doing. What's it like when you're working with a new work, such as the Hartmann, the Simplicius Simplicissimus?
It's a... I think we're generally doing the same thing all the time, but knowing the styles of the composer, when a conductor is in his or her formative years, this is so critical to know the difference in the styles. I think with modern opera, the first thing we forget is bel canto. We forget that everything that's written on a piece of paper has to be able to be sung, and it's so easy to get caught up in notes and rhythms and not make a musical phrase. And so I'm always, actually my harp teacher, Nancy Allen, said anytime you play modern music, make the most beautiful sounds you can, every bar. And it's such an obvious way of saying, I don't think there is any point when a composer would deliberately write ugly music. And I think with the Hartmann, it's a good example of, he wants philharmonic sounds. He wants beautiful string playing. And I always have to remind the players to keep in that frame of mind when they're playing music, even though it might look extremely black, extremely complicated.
Again, this is something that we are hearing so often now from Maestro Muti, from Maestro Haitink, phrasing that people have to remember, yes, it's great that they have all of this training to play their instrument now, and that a conductor pretty much can rely on the technical expertise of the orchestra as a collective and as the individual players, but that there always has to be that reminder that it's about where are the notes going and what is the phrase, and not just the back and forth across the fingerboard or the movement of the fingers on the wind or brass instrument pad. It's about making the music and making the phrasing.
It's actually a crisis of notation. If you look at Mozart, he writes piano and forte, and that's basically it. And he might write very rarely an Italian word, which is unbelievably revealing. Yeah, but when we get to modern music, we find we've got about seven different levels of dynamics. We've got articulation, and there's this mentality that if the composer doesn't write something, then we don't do it. Whereas it seems that the phrasing of the music, that has to be the most obvious thing. But we're inundated with so much information about the articulation, about the dynamics, that we stop thinking about the grammar of music, that it needs to sound like a sentence. We have to connect the four bars. We have to, and this is a composer, it's really, you're incapable of showing that in the notation, but it's something we get lost in too much information and we neglect the obvious when we do modern music.
The Schulte Foundation U.S. grant gives you some money. It also gives you introductions and a chance to spend some time, part of what you're doing this first week of November here in Chicago when we're talking to meet with and sit in on rehearsals and performances at the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. Not a bad conductor in town this week, the principal conductor, Bernard Haitink. Also over at the Lyric Opera of Chicago, where you have Andrew Davis and a very fine Verdi conductor, Renato Palumbo, and maybe Emmanuel Villaume is arriving to start working on Merry Widow. What are your own plans for the period that you have the grant? Are there some things that the grant is going to allow you to do that you might have either been putting off or hadn't yet thought about doing?
Yeah, I, in particular, having a piano at home, renting a piano, starting viola lessons. I took one summer of viola, and I realize every time I stand in front of an orchestra, I want to be able to tell the string players why they need to play legato. But there's the string players I find are always thinking with their right arm. It's a lazy, it's a very lazy joint in the body. And I find I'm constantly wanting to talk to the string body about what they're doing with their bow. And I want to be, in 2 years, I want to be very clear about what I want. And I want to be able to pick it up and show them if they don't do it. And I also want to improve my Italian, improve my French. I'm fluent in German after my time there. And I realize when I thumb through a Puccini score, it just takes me too long to... I've got my dictionary next to me. It's just inefficient in time. I would be much better to really perfect as much as I possibly can my Italian language.
I need to underscore for those of you who don't have the video portion of this program that Eric Nielsen does not look like a weirdo. You would not say, uh-oh, here comes Brainiac if he was walking towards you. He is a very normal-looking person who has all of this intelligence and interest and passion and wants to add the viola to his oboe, harp, and conducting arsenal, but for reasons that make a great deal of sense and obviously are all about serving the music, and that, of course, is the purpose of the conductor, as Eric has also mentioned, and particularly fitting, too, that we know of the viola sometimes as the composer's instrument, not as the conductor's instrument, and that's more important, isn't it?
To be honest, I picked the viola. First of all, I love reading the alto clef, but I want to play a Haydn string quartet. I think, and I feel like that is would be an achievable goal to play the viola part in a Haydn string quartet.
Well, we'll wait for the reviews on Eric's playing of the viola, but I will share with you a couple of sentences from the New York Times from two different reviews that might make Eric blush a bit. But Anthony Tomasini and Alan Cozen, two gentlemen who know Tanglewood very well, who know James Levine very well, and who know music very well. Tony Tomasini speaking about Eric's conducting of Rise and Fall of Mahagoni, the City of Mahagoni at Tanglewood in 08, says the highlight was Mr. Nielsen's cool, incisive, and gripping conducting. He drew dynamic playing from the excellent orchestra and seemed at home in a challenging score. And Alan Cozen, from a month or just 2 weeks before, speaking of the Carter program, says that Eric Nielsen, an already accomplished conducting fellow, led the performance of the Elliott Carter Clarinet Concerto with decisiveness and assurance, a quality he also supplied in a vital account of dialogues with Nicholas Hodges playing the dazzling solo piano line. So you don't just need to take my word or the word of the Schulte Foundation U.S. You got the New York Times stamp of approval as well. We hope to have the chance to check in with Eric Nielsen again in the future as he develops additional skills, and we hope also as he starts to conduct more on this side of the Atlantic. Are you worried at all that after 8 years of living in Europe and getting used to the rhythms and the style and the ways of life and of work there, and also because, of course, a talented young American conductor can make a good career staying in Europe, are you concerned at all about how it's going to be as you start to take on more assignments and perhaps eventually appointments here in the States?
I'm dreaming of coming back to my country, if I may say so. I consider it a good thing for a conductor to know the world and to have lived and breathed other cultures. I think if seeing a German forest makes somehow the music of Schubert or Schumann have a different flavor, it has a different meaning, and I'm happy to have experienced that. But I'm certainly dreaming of coming back to the States and living here and making music here.
We look forward to that. Eric Nielsen, thank you so much for your thoughtful comments, your insights, your generosity of spirit. I also have to underscore something that you did throughout our conversation, and I know it just happens with you spontaneously. You credited your teachers going back to grade school in each of these areas. And on FMT, we talk about this all the time, the importance not only of music for young people, but of who it is who's bringing that music to them. And teachers make a tremendous stamp on a person. And to have good teachers and to understand that you couldn't have gotten where you are, one couldn't have gotten where one is without those guiding ideas and hands is a very important thing and a salutary thing that you remind people of that so naturally.
It's a blessing to have a school music program. And that I think I was very lucky in the state of Kansas that they had school music. That was what made me who I am, was the chance to, I went to, in fifth grade, the teacher came and said, I didn't want to play the flute, the clarinet, the saxophone, the trumpet, or the drums. I wanted to play something a little different. And I went to him and I said, what can I do? And I said, I play the piano. And he said, well, you can play the oboe. And that was the deciding moment for me. It's an instrument like singing. It's the closest to the human voice, I think. And it defined me as a musician, I think.
Eric Nielsen, 2009 Fellow of the Schulte Foundation U.S., thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Dieses Bild bezeugt, dass in allem, was ist, ein Gott lebt. Wie ein Prinzip ist der Stoff, das Gold, das ihr geschenkt habt. Anschaulich wandelbar, wie alles andere Zweite, ist die Gestalt, die ich ihm gegeben. Verehrt euch selbst in die
music you heard tonight included the opening of The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni of Kurt Weill and Bertolt Brecht from the 1956 German recording of the full opera as then understood, with Lotte Lenya and others, Wilhelm Bruckner Rüggeberg conducting. And from Moses und Aaron, the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and Sir George Schulte, music of Arnold Schoenberg. We'd like to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great. We'd like to thank Betty Bucheri and Fiona Queen from the Schulte Foundation U.S., and Lady Valerie Schulte and other members of the foundation for bringing Eric Nielsen to Chicago and to us. We'd like to thank our funders, Alphawood Foundation and the Kovler Family Foundation, as well as other friends of this program. Let us know what you thought about this or any of our other programs. Drop us a line at RENTAP, that's Patner spelled backwards, RENTAP at AOL.com. And while we have you thinking in a computerized frame of mind, visit us on the web, WFMT.com/oneword, critical thinking, where you can experience the Critical Thinking podcast. I'm Andrew Patner. We'll see you next week.